Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have an amazing show for you this evening, and a tradition here at Social Flight Live. We have Major General Mark D. Piper, Deputy Director of Operations at NORAD, and we are going to talk about his personal story, NORAD's history, their mission, their recent defense activities, and protecting the United States and Canada. And with our wrap-up, of course, we're also going to be talking about their amazing and fun Santa Tracker that they do every year. And if you know a young person that is related to you or even not, that is something you definitely want to make sure they know about, because it's an awful lot of fun. Before we get started, just a few things. Well, things, even though the weather is getting colder, things are really booming inside of Social Flight. We have tons of events, holiday events, Santa events that are happening, hangar dances, all sorts of things, and tons of educational events with webinars and shows just like this, as well as Social Flight's FAA Learning Center, where we have WINGS courses that you can take for FAA WINGS credit, as well as Aviation Maintenance Technician Program, that awards program. All you need to do is take the courses for that and our courses for IA renewal. If you are an airframe and power plant mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can get your 8 hours of continuing education for free directly at socialflight.com and in the free Social Flight mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Just go register, check it out, and everything is there. You even get legal certificates to use for that IA renewal. In addition to that, we have our Destination Digest. Social Flight's got tons of places to fly. We tell you about places to go, whether you have crew cars there, places to stay, places to eat. It's all in there. And last, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. That's right, we just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset to John Southworth of Edmonton, Kentucky. And we are now giving away another one on February 1st. That's the amazing Lightspeed headset that has carbon monoxide detection built into it, customized hearing through their hearing acuity program. It's very, very cool, amazing headset. You can win that just by getting the Social Flight free app and checking in at your local airport or any other airports. Even if you only check in once during the prize period, you're entered in the drawing to win. But if you get on the leaderboard and check in all sorts of different places, you get extra entries, which can increase your chances. So check all of that out. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Avidyne and the amazing IFD 550, 540, and 440 series of navigators, and the new Avidyne Vantage system that is literally going to revolutionize the panels of Cirrus aircraft. I will say that the IFD 550 and 440 we use in our Bonanza is stellar. It helps us fly instrument conditions all the time. And also in this Mustang you see that we're building right behind me, we have a 550 going in that as well. So be sure to check out all of that. We even have a video showing how we can taxi that using a camera that's displayed on the IFD 550. Very, very cool things. So now on to tonight's show. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, is a binational United States and Canadian organization charged with the missions of aerospace warning and aerospace control for North America. Major General Mark Piper is the Deputy Director of Operations for the North American Aerospace Defense Command at Peterson Space Force Base in Colorado. He's responsible for supporting the execution and future planning of the aerospace warning, aerospace control, and maritime warning for the North American area, including Canadian, Alaskan, and continental United States NORAD regions. General Piper received his commission from the United States Air Force Academy in 1995. He is a command pilot with more than 2,400 hours in fighter aircraft, including more than 300 combat hours in support of operations Northern Watch, Southern Watch, Iraqi Freedom, and Enduring Freedom. His flight experience includes the T-37, the T-38, F-16, and F-22. I am absolutely thrilled to have him join us here tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Major General Mark Piper.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Wonderful. General Piper, thank you so, so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here this evening on Social Flight Live.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Hey, I'd like to start with your personal background because I found your biography fascinating, and it made me wonder, going all the way back, at what point did you see yourself joining the military and especially getting airborne and seeing the possibility of becoming a pilot? Like, was it in your family? Was it not? Like, what? Tell me how this whole career for you got started.
Always dangerous asking a pilot to talk about him or herself, right? But just to kind of answer your question, I grew up in Northwest Ohio, and I think probably like most people that are, you know, my age, I had a poster of a Lamborghini Countach on my wall, a picture of an SR-71, and a picture of an F-16, some combination of that. And I think that, and then up the road, there was a guard unit that was flying A-7s at the time. So, you know, early on in the late 70s, early 80s, it just seemed like something that was exciting, and never really let go of that dream. So I was fortunate enough to be selected to go to the Air Force Academy, graduated, went to pilot training, and that's how I got started in the aviation world.
Did you, what was your exposure ahead of time, other than just looking up and seeing this? Did you know pilots growing up, or was there anyone in your family?
There was not. This was really an abstract thing until I got kind of my first flight at the Academy. I had never been up in a small airplane before. I had never really known anyone. It was really aspirational, but fortunately that was good enough.
That's what a wonderful story. And was there any military sites? So what was it? I'm always curious, especially for people as accomplished as you, what made them decide a life of service, and especially military and then in the Air Force, is the right path? Because it's a very different journey to go to the Academy versus any other civilian path.
I think the things that may get you into a particular career field may not necessarily be the things that keep you in a particular career field. I wish I could say it was maybe more sophisticated or more selfless than it actually was at the time. My desire to go to the Academy was simply based on the greatest percentage and greatest likelihood of being able to go to pilot training. So I'm very glad I went. Great place to go. I encourage people to go there. My story may not be as sophisticated as some others.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, how did you find the Academy? Was it did it feel like a good fit, or was it a struggle to kind of make your way through there?
It's a good question. I think, no, if anyone ever feels completely comfortable there, then you're not really being challenged and you're not getting the most out of the Academy. I think one of the clear purposes of any military academy is to challenge you. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, no, I didn't feel comfortable, but I think that's the point. But in terms of the people that were there, and especially people that continue to be my lifelong friends, it never felt like anything other than home.
Yeah, that certainly, you know, makes sense. And I think one of the benefits of your story and your background for going into that is that I've heard before that a huge risk is when people do come from, let's say, a military family or something like that, they sort of have to challenge what their personal desire is compared to what the expectations are that have been set upon them, which is hard, I've been told, to survive in the academy environment if it's not internal.
I would agree with that. I think if you just kind of check pride at the door, which really goes for any sort of basic military training, you're already halfway there. You're there to learn. You're there to be challenged. There's going to be points where you're going to get frustrated or angry. So maybe there's a little bit of, you know, intelligence that goes into being able to get through the academy, but there's probably a lot of just perseverance, if not maybe a little bit of stubbornness as well.
So what was your first assignment when you graduated the academy? Tell me a little bit about your first assignment and your first deployment.
So I did just a little bit of time at the academy as a casual status lieutenant, waiting to go to pilot training, went to pilot training. And then my first assignment As a lieutenant, after going through pilot training and being fortunate enough to get an F-16 out of pilot training, my first operational assignment was at Kunsan Air Base in Korea.
I noticed that Korea was pretty prominent in your history. Had you ever, was that just essentially no control, it's where you were sent, or what did, had you ever had kind of interest in being there? That's an interesting place to serve.
No, it was a fascinating place to serve. Never thought twice about it. I just, that was kind of the place where I was sent, and it was really positively just an influence that really, I think, set my career on the right path. And what I mean by that was it was a remote assignment. So there at the time, especially 25 years ago in Korea, there wasn't necessarily a lot to do in that location other than just, you know, live, breathe, eat, sleep, aviation. So as a lieutenant, there was no better operational environment to live in than in Korea. A combination of the camaraderie, the teamwork, being in a theater with the threat just up north, as we would say, it was really the best military assignment for a new lieutenant fighter pilot that I could possibly think of.
How would you compare the kind of operational tensions that existed there with North Korea at the time and perhaps even China 25 years ago compared to where we are now and how that affects kind of your different viewpoint when you were there versus NORAD now?
Well, when I think back to when I was in Kunsan in 1998-1999, very focused kind of on the aircraft I was flying. Like mm-hmm. That's how you think about what you're doing, you know, as a lieutenant or as a captain. You're very focused on the tactical application of your aircraft. Tactics, techniques, procedures, what are we doing? It's very that's your job. Interestingly enough, that was, you know, that's kind of the steam driven days, as I like to say, in the fighter world. We didn't have any of the kind of modern avionics or toys, if you want to say it that way, back in that day. We did not have GPS. We did not have a targeting pod. We did not have night vision goggles. We did not have data link. We were still dropping gravity bombs. That was the environment that we were in. And so it was, you know, obviously, a fighter aircraft is a very technical piece of engineering. But when I look at what that was back then versus what we have now, it was a different type of flying. And so while there may be things that I felt were, you know, kind of Neanderthal, if you will, in terms of capabilities, it absolutely did teach me from an aviation standpoint just the real basics of aviation. For example, not having a computer to do all the sensor fusion for you. You had to build your situational awareness in your brain. Flying in actual weather, not just one that was in a simulator or, you know, my pilot training was in Laughlin, Texas and in Phoenix, Arizona. Not a lot of clouds, not a lot of bad weather in those locations. So just that first assignment of really just getting into organic military aviation and what was needed, I think is very formative. And that was different than where I sit now, which is we're 25 years of rapidly accelerating technology. And my job now is to think much more at the operational level, at the theater level, at the strategic level. So, you know, the North Korea I focused on 25 years ago is in some ways the same way as they, you know, were then as they are now. But just my job and how I think about them goes through a different lens than when I was a lieutenant in the late 90s.
That makes perfect sense. At that time, or when you were there, were there the same kind of situations with airspace and kind of essentially cat and mouse with fighters on either side or missions that are happening on either side of the airspace as parallels with what we see and we'll talk about later in the show with air defense identification zone intrusions that are happening these days?
So my first assignment 25 years ago, not really. North Korea barely flew at all back then. They were still trying to kind of figure out, I think, what their focus was. Not to say they don't have an Air Force today, but I think more of the threat is viewed from North Korea. Certainly comes to their interest in missiles, in intercontinental ballistic missiles, in their theater missiles. So, you know, Yes. It's always going to be a little bit of a cat and mouse. Sometimes they'll put a little bit more focus in one area than the other. But I think just, you know, their nefarious intent and the fact that we're always going to be watching them is something that is just an enduring thing that has not changed a bit in the last 25 years.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your combat operations that you flew. We listed in the beginning of the show that you were on Northern Watch, Southern Watch, Iraqi Freedom, and Enduring Freedom. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to deploy in those operations?
So after I left Korea, I went to Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, and that's where my Northern Watch and Southern Watch deployments were. And that was interesting insofar as our military objective was kind of to maintain the status quo. That is what we were tasked to do, and is to kind of keep the problem contained. And that was the approach that we took. So there was always the threat of, you know, occasionally the Iraqis would shoot at us, but there wasn't necessarily a lot of reciprocal kinetic action on our part. Our main job was to just make sure that the Iraqi Air Force stayed on the ground at the time, and that the situation essentially stayed what it was. So that mm-hmm. was a different environment than, you know, say 5 to 10 years later in Iraq and Afghanistan, where our objectives were different.
Got it. And in Iraqi Freedom, what was your role in that regard?
So in both Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, I deployed really in a close air support role. That was what our job was, and it was supporting whomever the ground commander was and whatever ground troops were there. In the moments of kind of lower tension, the most we might do is kind of a show of force, where we might do a lower altitude flyby at high speed and full afterburner just to kind of scare the enemy out of contact. Other times we would do kinetic strikes based upon whatever the guidance was from the ground commander objectives.
And what did you have? What was your experience in combat for the first time when you were actually doing kinetic combat?
So I think most people think that, when you think of aviation combat, you know, it probably has a certain Hollywood aspect to it, which, you know, whether or not you're talking about, I guess I would say people think about, hey, the bombs and the bullets that are potentially going by you, or the actual, you know, pickling off a weapon or those sorts of things. What I kind of remember the most intense focus was required were actually on aviation basics, getting on the right frequency, making sure I knew where the tanker was, getting on with the tanker boom and refueling in an expedited manner. The training that we do is, at least as fighter pilots every day, you know, we do the threat reactions every day. We do the, you know, simulated attacks every day. You can practice that stuff in the simulator. You can practice in training. That translates extremely well between the training environment and the combat environment. But in terms of just all the fog and friction that can occur, it's usually in what would seemingly be the more mundane things of, all right, which frequency card am I supposed to be looking at? Am I on the right radio? There's comm jamming I wasn't expected. You know, this SATCOM receiver is not working. Just working through all those things that you may not necessarily have been exposed to in training. So I can't imagine the training being any better than it was. That's just something that we frankly do really well in the military. But there's still no substitute for just those sorts of things in combat. I might give a similar analogy to, you can learn to fly an aircraft really, really well in a simulator, but there's no substitute. It's hard to get true airmanship unless you actually have some air under your butt, if you know what I mean.
Wow. And I noticed you talked about deploying and flying the F-16. When did you fly the F-22?
So the F-22 was much later in my career. I only flew it for about a year. Quite a cherry on top of my aviation sundae, if you will. And that was at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, where I was privileged to be the wing commander of the 192nd Wing, Virginia Air National Guard, working with our active duty partners in the 1st Fighter Wing with the F-22s there at Langley.
Wow. And how would you describe the F-22 and flying it?
Well, I think we all fall in love with our first aircraft to a certain way, or at least the one we've flown the most. And so maybe the F-16 will always be my first love, but the privilege of flying the F-22, it's just an absolute killing machine. And the amount of situational awareness that you're provided in the cockpit is a little overwhelming, especially for someone that learned that aircraft late in their career. But just for what people see, I'm sure many of your listeners here on the call have watched the F-22 demo over the years, and I've flown the aircraft, and I still don't know how it does what it does. So it was a year-long appreciation tour for what great engineering can accomplish.
That's so cool. Well, let's turn our attention to NORAD itself. And if you could set a baseline, because there's a lot of different organizations, obviously, that are involved in national defense and international defense and alliances that we have. And so it can be often very confusing who does what. But give us a baseline for NORAD's control, NORAD's missions.
So NORAD has been tasked since 1958. So we're going into our 66th year of, in very simple terms, defending North America. And we've been doing that 24/7, 365 since we originated. That really breaks down into primarily day-to-day, a mission of detection and deterrence against any of our adversaries. But if necessary, we are prepared to defend and defeat any adversaries if we get to that level of escalation. The mission areas, as you kind of already mentioned, really for us break down into three, and that's aerospace warning, aerospace control, and maritime warning was added to NORAD's mission set in the mid-2000s. So in terms of day-to-day operations, we achieve our detection and our deterrence, and if needed, our training for defeat through those three mission areas. What I think is as much or even kind of more interesting about NORAD is not just what we do, but how we do it, because we are a binational command. And anytime you have multiple countries that are working together, there's levels to how much countries work together. And from being here at NORAD, I can sincerely say that NORAD really is the gold standard in terms of how two nations can work together. And I'll explain it this way. There are nations that can operate together by just mere deconfliction. You do your own thing over there and we'll do our own thing over here and we won't get in each other's way. That's kind of the basic level. I think the mid-level might be described as cooperation, where there's at least a little bit of coordination with what two nations may be doing together. And then there's full integration, which is what I view as kind of the varsity level of how two countries can work together. And that's what I've found here at NORAD is really deep integration. And let me give an example or a few examples of what I mean by that. So here at NORAD in the headquarters, my boss, Major General Radiff, is a Canadian two-star general, and he's not the director of operations for Canadian portion of NORAD. He is the director of operations for NORAD. And so it doesn't really matter if we're using US assets or Canadian assets for our mission, he's the director of operations. And that's just how we do business. If you look at kind of our regions, of which we have three, we have the Alaska region, the Canada region, and the continental United States region, they all have commanders, but their deputy commanders are of the opposite nationality. So we have Canadian deputy commanders in Alaska and in the continental United States region for NORAD, and we have an American deputy in Canada. And when the commander is not available, whoever the deputy, she or he is, has the full authority to operate as the commander would. And that especially plays out for when we're doing like real world operational missions and someone is acting as the CFAC, the coalition Air Forces, commander, they have full tactical control of whatever asset is required within their region, and the nationality really doesn't matter. I think that's very unique. I'll give one other example here. We have a joint operations center here in Colorado Springs at NORAD headquarters, and the positions here are not really set up into the Canadian desk and the American desk or anything like that. Some days when I come on shift, we have a Canadian who's the center director for that particular shift and an American deputy, and other days it's the opposite way. And that's just how we do business. So that has, you know, not occurred overnight. That really has been something we've been doing for over 66 years, and it really is a synergistic relationship, and something that I have found is extremely unique in how we go about the defense of North America.
That's really fascinating. And is it by design, not just the integration at that level, but you've mentioned each time that the primary in a role, the director, let's say, and the deputy are of different nationalities. Is that by design?
I think we try to have just a balance of perspectives, if you will. At the end of the day, of course, there are going to be, you know, two sovereign nations may not necessarily agree on everything at the policy level. What we want to make sure that we have here is just seamless operational integration. The policy exists at a different level. What we're focused on right now is just making sure that our respective training pipelines, our respective career management, all the things, just make sure that we bring our most talented and our best trained folks to sit in whatever chair that is, in a way that we kind of don't want anyone to know the difference when it comes to the operational and tactical execution of the mission.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I find it's interesting because I think the average civilian of either nation perhaps or whatever views these different organizations and doesn't truly understand NORAD versus so many other things that we hear. Like when we hear of NATO, that's essentially a coalition. Mm-hmm. And that NORAD is just the United States and Canada. It's fascinating to me because you are deep operational at all times. It's mm-hmm. not just an organization with deployments in certain ways. You are literally protecting the all of North America, as you mentioned, which is a day-to-day operational, have to be on duty all the time, as opposed to what we're going to do for a particular hotspot activity happening in Europe or something like that. Can you help people understand a little more about that?
Well, I think that there is, with what we have at NORAD, as a binational command, there is a strategic alliance to that, there's an operational alliance to that, and there's a tactical alliance to it. And we're continually operating across all those three for what we kind of call the levels of war, to ensure that there is continual dialogue to make sure not only are we aligned in, you know, potentially what our political objectives are, or policy level objectives, that's obviously above the level of the NORAD command. But when those policy objectives come down to us, that again, it's a seamless transition to operations and tactics. Hope I answered your question on that.
Yes, it did. The other thing which you could please help clarify for me is often we think of something like NORAD as being very externally facing. Looking at it in terms of borders and an outward look. And yet my understanding is that NORAD plays an extremely significant role internally to the countries in terms of TFR enforcement, temporary flight restriction enforcement, in terms of other securities that happen. Can you explain a little bit about the nuances beyond just looking outward from the borders?
You bet. And I think I'll just start from the very definition of a threat is that you might not always know where it's coming from, and it could come from anywhere. And that's just kind of a geographic origin. So I'll start with, I think, what most people think about with NORAD, which is the air domain. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about traditional NORAD threats, you know, from our origin, our original history, it was very much an external threat. It was a Cold War threat. It was, you know, it was the distant early warning line. It was Russian bombers. It was very Cold War. And we want to make sure that we could detect any bombers that were coming inbound or any missiles that were coming inbound to North America. So that was definitely an external threat that was the bulk of the focus for NORAD's first several decades of its existence. That continues to be something that has a large focus for what we do every day. But in addition to that, we also monitor not just the air domain, but we also monitor the space domain in conjunction with SPACECOM. So any reentries or any potential threat that could come from space, whether or not it's an intercontinental ballistic missile or some sort of satellite reentry, we make sure that we monitor that and provide assessments from the NORAD perspective for anything that might potentially be a threat to North America. So that's kind of the space domain. We also have the maritime domain, so we work closely with the intel community to make sure that we are monitoring all the potential threats that exist in the maritime domain as well. I think with everyone can imagine, the longer and longer weapons ranges get, it doesn't take an enemy vessel to get very far off their own coast before they can potentially pose a threat to North America, so we monitor that very closely. Probably, I guess this is good at any time to get into the fact that we have to be a multi-domain command. If our adversaries are going to attack us, it's not necessarily going to be just through one of the physical domains. The cyber threat and the potential attacks that could be done by our adversaries is something that could disrupt all of our military operations and our ability to defend the homeland, so we pay attention to that as well. So those, I think, are all kind of external malicious actors, if you will. But also day-to-day, especially since 9/11, we've also been focused on the potential for extremist organizations and internal threats, whether or not it's an extremist organization or someone with criminal intent. So if there is any sort of threat from potential hijacking of airliners, stolen aircraft, anything like that, that is also something that we monitor continually and have processes in place to respond to that as appropriate.
So when a temporary flight restriction violation occurs by, let's see, a civilian aircraft, I didn't realize in the past that is a NORAD a coordinated activity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So we have areas where we will set up temporary flight restrictions, usually based upon either a priority national security event or always 24/7, 365 around the National Capital Region of Washington, D.C. If the President of the United States is traveling, we will set up a temporary flight restriction around that area, and we will monitor any aircraft around that and set up different levels of response depending on how big the temporary flight restriction area is, what level of threat we assess, and multiple factors. So I think the point is, you know, for us is that we monitor that continually. Sometimes we do that with just monitoring. Other times we will scramble a helicopter to respond to an aircraft that is not squawking and talking. Other times we will send fighters. Other times it'll be fighters already pre-positioned overhead. The point is, we want to maintain a posture of constant vigilance for those particular situations.
And those are all coordinated by NORAD. So that when we read about those stories of the wayward pilot that didn't read about the TFR and wasn't talking on the right frequency and all of a sudden has an escort, the timeline of that is that essentially NORAD is watching and NORAD is deploying or directing those assets. Is that accurate?
That is correct. I would describe us as we've kind of facilitate and orchestrate the conferencing and the comms that go into that response, but it's not just NORAD. We can rapidly bring in, literally within a matter of seconds, multiple different agencies to make sure that we resolve it in the most rapid and clear manner. So that will include everyone from the FAA, and our air traffic control representatives, the Secret Service, potentially law enforcement. There are a whole gamut of people that will participate in these conferences to make sure that we get as much info to the right people at the right time, and we can resolve it and hopefully get as much clarity as quickly as possible. It is not our intent to be, jumping to any particular conclusions. Certainly my public service announcement would be it's never a bad time to read the NOTAMs to make sure you know where you're going. And that just because it was clear yesterday doesn't mean it was clear today. But we're not looking to shoot first and ask questions later. We're really trying to get at, hey, what is the nature of this? Is it someone that just is NORDO? Is this a potential threat? And we try to bring all that information to bear very, very quickly. And NORAD is kind of the central facilitator of that process.
Got it. And this is the first time that I was aware that NORAD also has a role in the cyberspace as far as in managing threats.
So I would say that's our primary responsibility. But what I would say, and I think everyone understands the fact that, say in the air domain, there is nothing that we do that doesn't in some way, shape or form require a connection to a space capability such as GPS or a connection to a cyber capability, which is, you know, checking on your phone to make sure you got the right NOTAMs. And if we don't have those things, that's just some basic aviation things that go away. If you get into some of the larger aspects of this from a military standpoint of how do we make sure that our critical infrastructure is defended? How do we make sure our military network and communication is resilient and can be operational in contested environment? There's really no one in the military that doesn't have to think about the cyber domain and, and make sure that we are, you know, attuned to that threat and mitigating those threats appropriately.
So one of the things, of course, is that there have been a fair number of public news events recently, or recently meaning over the past 12 to even 24 months, having to do with Air Defense Identification Zone or ADIZ intrusions and even joint exercises between the Russians and the PRC, the People's Republic of China, and their forces on NATO boundaries, on NATO airspace. Can you talk a little bit about what has happened, and then we'll go into a little bit more detail about how NATO responds to that?
So NATO versus NORAD, we do work together, but I'm
sorry, I said that by mistake. I meant NORAD, of course.
You bet. So I'll start with kind of Russian long-range aviation. They kind of got back into long-range aviation business around 2007. That's where we started to see, you know, them doing out-of-area deployments to include penetrations of our ADIZ, Air Defense Identification Zones. I think probably most people on the call here are familiar with those, but I'll just say that I think it's important to note the difference. Oftentimes people think that if there is a ADIZ penetration, that means that somehow someone is violating our sovereign airspace, and that's not necessarily the case. Air Defense Identification Zones, very indifferent, very in distance from the coastline of Canada, the United States for the NORAD region. And a lot of that air defense identification zone is in international airspace. So, you know, per kind of international law and international norms, say the Russian military is allowed to fly in that airspace, but it's something that we monitor and we pay attention to it, and we want to make sure that we're in a position to respond. So when they would do out of area deployments and they would, you know, fly into our air defense identification zones, that had an uptick, you know, started again in earnest in about 2007. And over the years, they've had some years where they've been very busy and other years where they've really not done anything. It's gone like as high as 15 ADIZ incursions per year, and some years there haven't been any. I think as most people probably would not find surprising, at the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, they seemed to deprioritize their long-range aviation program, but that didn't last for too long. And really over the last year and a half or so, we've seen their long-range aviation activity return to kind of historical norms. So in 2024, we've released about 11 public statements from NORAD where we've, you know, identified when Russian aircraft have entered our ADIZ and our response to that.
And during those that history, those past, let's say, to going back 2 years, have they only been ADIZ intrusions, or has there been any violations into sovereign airspace?
So not into sovereign airspace, but that doesn't mean there are not some concerns in what we've seen recently. And I'll give you two examples. The first one was in July. So July, not only do we have a long-range Russian aviation that was executing a out-of-area, kind of aviation deployment, but they also actually flew in coordination with the People's Republic of China Air Force. And that's one of the first times where we've seen them operating, especially up in the northern and the Arctic area together. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're integrated. In fact, I'm confident in saying they're nowhere near the level of integration that we have here in NORAD. But in terms of just what they are doing, it obviously gets our attention when we see any cooperation between the PRC and Russia. In addition, in July, that was really the first time that we had seen one of the long-range Chinese bombers, the H-6.
That's what this is.
Yeah, operate outside of kind of the Western Pacific. It was the first time that we had seen it going up into the Arctic. So I think that demonstrates that China's very interested in the Arctic. They are interested in potentially doing more cooperation with Russia. And that only makes, you know, kind of what we do, you know, just it definitely got our attention and makes us, you know, just have to ensure that we're ready to respond to that new way of doing business between both China, their greater interest in the Arctic, and the increase in cooperation between Russia and China.
How, there must be some type of, even if it's an unwritten protocol, when aircraft are this close, they're, as you mentioned, they're in the air defense identification zone, they're outside sovereign airspace, but these are fast planes. And so making a left turn is certainly possible at any time really quickly. What's the protocol for what you do? Here we have, you know, imagery of NATO aircraft intercepting this PRC bomber. Tell me how this goes to understand when it's routine and when you worry it isn't.
So I think there's a combination of two things. Number one is there are some formal agreements and frameworks, at least between Canada, the United States, and the Russian Federation. And then there's what I'll just call some basic aviation norms. So first I'll talk about kind of the formal framework that was originally created in 1989 between the United States and the Soviet Union at the time, and then 1 year later in 1990 between Canada and the Soviet Union, to ensure that the prevention of dangerous military activities is really what it was designed to address. And it was things like pre-notification. If you were just going to fly into a particular area, perhaps there'd be some pre-notification that would go on between nations. Safe use of lasers would be an example. And it was designed to ensure that a small incident didn't escalate into something larger. And that if we were doing potentially deterrence patrols or things like that, that it didn't escalate into something that was unsafe. So that formal framework still exists today, at least between the Russian Federation and the United States and Canada. There's no formal agreement right now with China, but that kind of segues into the second portion, which is what I'll call just kind of basic aviation norms that should be understood by, you know, anyone who's flown an airplane, especially a military airplane. And that really dovetails into an unfortunate event we had in September that my guess is a lot of people on this call saw the footage of what we consider at NORAD to be an extremely unsafe interaction between a Russian fighter and an American fighter. So when we do this, you know, for the way that most of these go, it's a very benign intercept. It's very slow rates of rejoin, if you will. We keep our distance, you know, usually not much closer than a mile away. So close enough to be seen, close enough to allow mutual awareness, but nothing that would be perceived as aggressive or dangerous, you know, at least when we're kind of in, you know, what I'll call the detection and deterrence phase, right? We monitor and respond. And that's where 99% of these incidents end. An ATIS penetration happens, we respond, we monitor, we make sure we have presence, and that's about the end of it. What you probably saw in September was something that was well outside the norm. And that was a Russian fighter getting to at least, I think, probably 10 feet from an American fighter aircraft with at least 50 knots of overtake, and really required some last-ditch maneuvering to avoid a mid-air collision. That's something that's well outside the norm and something that we think is well out of bounds. And I think most people understand how dangerous that is, but I'll just give a quick aviation context here is, you know, for anyone that's flown in formation, close formation, especially with fighters or say on the tanker, you know, getting within 10 feet of another aircraft for wingtip clearance is not inherently dangerous. It's done all the time. But that's done with a very slow, methodical moving in from a mile to 1,000 feet to 500 feet to 100 feet. And it's very controlled and there's no surprises. At the rate of overtake that this Russian fighter was coming from really the 6 o'clock position, towards one of our fighters that was a mile away from the bomber that we were intercepting. Easily 50 knots overtake, probably more than that. For context, when we're training in fighters for, say, dogfighting or basic fighter maneuvers or those sorts of things, when we're maneuvering with that level of aggression or we're maneuvering with 50 or potentially 100 knots of overtake, our minimum distance from another aircraft for safety reasons is 500 feet, not 10 feet. And especially if it's a dissimilar aircraft that we are not used to fighting, we'll often bump that training bubble, as we call it, out to 1,000 feet. So what we would consider for a dynamic maneuvering target for something with 50 or 100 knots overtake, you know, we consider safe to be 500 to 1,000 feet. And that's in a training environment with two people that know what's going on. So when you have, you know, two aircraft from adversary nations that haven't pre-briefed the maneuvers, you have high rates of overtake, and, you know, we're having a close pass of 10 feet. That's something that we haven't seen before. That occurred in September, and that was of grave concern to us. So the location of what's been going on is not out of the norm. The frequency of what's been going on is not necessarily out of the norm, but who has been participating and how they've been participating are things that are of concern to us, and we're definitely monitoring very closely.
That's excellent information. Good to know. I've got another image here which shows the intercept in the way that you traditionally would do it on the this is the what the TU 50 the I think that's the Russian.
That's a cool story for me, but it looks like a TU 95 bear from
yes,
here.
Bear. And so you had mentioned, like, for example, in September's, it was a NATO aircraft that was doing an intercept of a Russian bomber before this incident happened. And that would have been in this kind of controlled, slow manner, as is pictured here.
Yeah, when NORAD intercepts the bombers, sometimes they're flying by themselves, sometimes they're flying in formation with other bombers, other times they have fighter escorts. It depends on what Russia decides to do that day. But our overall approach is really the same. We'll make sure that they know that we are there and that we're capable of responding, and we'll monitor them until they decide to go back home.
Mm-hmm. And when you have situations where you have ADIS incursions that are happening, I think one of the questions that many people have, not knowing a lot of the inside workings, is if you look at a regular sectional, the air defense identification zone versus land seems pretty small for aircraft that are as fast as they of course are. So what kind of protections are in place? Not asking any probing questions to things you can't talk about, but in general terms, what protections are in place should an aircraft go from something like this that's just cruising along the ADIS to all of a sudden making that proverbial left turn with malice?
Well, if there's one thing the military is good at, it's planning. And so we have plans that go all the way from, you know, what I'll call the competition phase, which is just day-to-day adversaries probing into our ADIS or greater activities in the Arctic, all the way through full conflict. And we have plans for that. We train to that. We have different authorities for that. And our command and control looks at ensuring that we can respond very quickly and not have to have a large ramp up time. So, you know, the aircraft that respond to, you know, what I'll call kind of our day-to-day operations still have live weapons on them. And you know, we can go from zero to full automatic at the drop of a hat if we need to. But that is a very conscious and disciplined and well-trained process. So it's not something where we're kind of making it up as we go. We don't go out there just to, you know, shout stop and say stop again if they don't stop. We actually have some muscle behind us if it gets to that point. That's not what we want to do. We always strive towards deterrence, but deterrence is not foolproof, and it's always best to negotiate from a position of strength, and that's kind of how we approach everything that we do.
That's very comforting to know, given, of course, all the things that we see in the news of what happens flying alongside, that it can change just as we can react just as quickly as a threat can develop in that regard. There's a few images I just wanted to show here about some NATO operations. One of the things I also wanted, you mentioned maritime. This was directly on NORAD site. I apologize for saying NATO before, but on NORAD site. And the fact that it includes maritime support is very interesting. And then also even during operations, we have training operations that have been happening over the past few years, there've been some significant exercises that have happened jointly between the Canadians and the United States military, and that's also very supported by NORAD.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
Yeah, I think that something that everyone understands is that the complexity of warfare and deterrence, the whole spectrum of conflict, that complexity only continues to grow over time, whether or not that is between domains, whether or not that is between, say, service components or between nations, or even between, you know, when you get into a lot of what is often called hybrid warfare or kind of the gray area of what actually constitutes warfare, there needs to be coordination with, you know, say, law enforcement. So it's not always easy to differentiate between, you know, okay, is the maritime threat clearly military in nature? Is it something that more might be a transnational criminal organization? They can still have malice towards the United States. And is that, you know, is that something that's more towards a Navy responsibility? Is that something that's more towards a Coast Guard responsibility, with the Coast Guard being both a military service and a law enforcement agency? Is it pure law enforcement? We have to always be thinking not only about, you know, detecting where folks are out there, but what do we do about it? Who is it? Mm-hmm. Who's the appropriate agency to respond under, you know, what authorities? And those are things that we're continually evolving. So in that regard, the only constant is change.
Makes perfect sense. And I will say this image from NORAD site is impressive. Full display that was out there of equipment.
Yeah, we you know, as NORAD, we certainly have a lot of potential hardware at our disposal, if you will, and that's really just, I think, you know, the tip of the spear that everybody loves, that portion of it. It's the one that I've lived for most of my career, but I also think that that's probably only 1% of the entire enterprise that goes behind that. And that's not just the maintainers and the people that keep up our airfields and air traffic control, but the people that get our systems and our communications to talk to each other, all the people that work through making sure our authorities are aligned up to do what we need to do quickly. It really is a coalition and a team effort to bring all these things to bear whenever it's needed.
The last thing in terms of mission, obviously, in the news recently, have been quite a lot of talk of things that have to do with drone sightings and drone activity that has happened. And even in an external battlefield environment, obviously, as we've seen in Ukraine, drones are becoming more and more of a focus. I think the last time that we had this show, the topic that was very talked about at the time was hypersonic missiles and what was involved in that technology and NORAD's advances in terms of ability to be able to defend against that. What can you tell me about the thought process at NORAD about drones?
So drones are a very, it's definitely an important topic. It has everyone's attention for understandable and the right reasons. And kind of just like I'll call it a boat that is out in the waters, it can mean many things. It can literally be anything from someone who has, they're taking their first boat out and they have not a shred of malicious intent, all the way towards, you know, a full armada of an adversary's navy. And drones are kind of the same way. So what is kind of on everyone's mind right now is, how do we take something that is as prevalent and ubiquitous and yet as broad as drones, and bring it into the who does what? And I'll say the idea, if anyone, I'd recommend looking up how the the DoD Press Secretary, Major General Pat Riordan, had a great analogy of new technology came out a long time ago of the automobile. We have automobiles driving around the United States all the time, and most of them don't have any nefarious intent. It's completely legal, and we've learned how to operate with that. And occasionally one of them tries to drive on one of our military installations, and we usually just check at the door and say, are you sure you're supposed to be here? And they turn around, it's no big deal. Other times they accidentally get on base and they don't have nefarious intent, and we deal with that. And on rare occasion, they actually do get on base with nefarious intent, and we have different ways to respond to all those. And drones are kind of just a different version of that. So I thought that was a very useful analogy, because sometimes, you know, it's a completely legitimate use and someone's using it completely legally, but it's close, and so we'll monitor it, but it's no problem. Other times it's an accidental incursion, and it might be a law enforcement issue. Other times it may become the purview of, say, our installation commanders in the military, which is where we get more involved. From the NORAD perspective, you know, we're monitoring all this right now, and what we're doing right now is, you know, focusing on making sure that all the different entities that come together, whether or not it's the FAA or law enforcement, United States Northern Command, Homeland Security, all the local and state and federal responders that are paying attention to this as well, we want to make sure that we are integrated with them from the beginning. Most of what we're seeing right now, I would deem more as security related. If this gets to be something that we consider to be kind of a national defense incident, where we're looking at, you know, warfighting use of swarming drones or those sorts of things, or we see a foreign nexus for intel collection or those sorts of things, that will kind of get more in our portfolio, and NORAD will take more of a lead role. Right now, we're more in a supporting role, but it's definitely something that we understand the interest in this. We're very interested in as well, and lots of different agencies are involved right now in how we address this kind of emerging phenomenon.
Has it also affected your strategies looking forward when you are looking at external intrusions and the potential for that? The idea of, as you were just talking about, intercepts and the ways to do intercepts outside of the borders of the United States and Canada. As you mentioned, you can field many drones more than you can field individual fighter planes or bomber planes or bombers. Is this an evolving strategy within NORAD about how to handle that?
Absolutely. Anytime you've got what I'll call it disruptive technology, you have to look at potentially a new way of doing business. Some things won't change, other things will have to adapt. So I can imagine this was, you know, in some ways, a similar version of this happened in the 1950s when intercontinental ballistic missiles came on the scene. And now that we've got, you know, maneuvering glide vehicles that can be attached to those, we've had to change how we approach that threat. And it is not only how we approach it from detection, it's how we approach it from deterrence, and how we look at it in terms of potential defeat mechanisms as well. So it is both unique and also very similar to any other technology that our adversaries could potentially use against us.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense, and I really do appreciate you filling us in on all that. I'd like to turn our attention as we get towards the top of the hour here to a really wonderful mission that NORAD does every single year, because the intercepts that you do are not only against adversaries, but you also do an awful lot of tracking come Christmas Eve of another individual. So tell us a little bit about NORAD's Track Santa and what everyone who knows young people in their life can be directing people both to your website, which is really fantastic, I will say. It's really, really wonderful. And also some of the other fun things that exist there along the way. And I'm showing some of those images, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, NORADSanta.org is the website that has a kind of a full history of how this great tradition came to bear. We are literally in our 69th year of doing this. It started in 1955. And it's really, I think it's just a great opportunity. We really like doing it here in NORAD. It's enjoyable for us. it's a couple of different things on why we like this activity. One, it's a great chance to kind of interact with the public and let them know that, hey, we do this 365 days per year. It's just this one's a little bit more special. So it's a great chance to interact with the public, and it brings joy to us as well. But really, it's about the joy that we can bring to families and children really around the world. So I think most people know it started with an accidental phone call in 1955 to a unlisted number in the headquarters with a child who was asking where Santa was, thought he was calling like a local hotline for a Santa tracker, and it just happened to be the headquarters. And so the colonel that answered the phone said, well, this is exactly where he is right now. And in some ways, the rest is history. So especially on December 24th, we have over 1,000 volunteers from NORAD, along with some community partners. And we man the phones and talk to people all around the world and track Santa and share the NORAD mission and share the joy. So it's enjoyable for us, and we hope it brings joy to everyone that calls our hotline.
It really is wonderful, and I really do appreciate that you do that. And I would recommend everyone, if you could say the website again, that brings everyone to it.
Yeah, it's NORADSanta.org, and then Hi NORAD is the phone number, 877-HI-NORAD. 877-HI-NORAD, that's our hotline. At a minimum, you'll get a recorded message, but we do have a lot of volunteers and live human beings on the phone. So if you don't get through, keep calling back. And we encourage children to call. And if you're a parent and you've got little kids that won't go to bed, you call us. We will remind kids that if they are not in bed asleep, that Santa will pass by your house and come back later. So if you're a parent that's kind of at the witching hour and your kids are staying up too late, we might be able to help you get your kids to bed.
I did not realize that was one of your services. That is absolutely spectacular. I'm going to tell a few people about that one. That's very good. Didn't realize that you served that that role as well. Well, Major General Piper, we've reached the top of the hour there. We have one thing we'd love to do, if it's okay with you, and that is Social Flight's Fast Five. Just with a few questions about you and your life and experience. So are you ready for that?
Let's do it.
All right. Major General Mark D. Piper, Deputy Director of Operations at NORAD. This is your Social Flight's Fast Five, five questions to let people get to know you just a little bit better. I'd like to start with question number one. You have flown a number of military aircraft during your time beginning at the Academy and prior to your current role at NORAD. Of those, what was your favorite aircraft and why?
Well, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to have to say two airplanes. I have been able to fly the F-22, which is definitely the most capable airplane and in some ways the most fun to fly. But my first fighter and the one I've flown the most is the F-16, and I think there's nothing better than flying an F-16 at 500 knots and at low altitude. So maybe that's a double answer. If I'm forced to pick, I'll go with the F-16.
Fair enough. We'll let you go with both of those as your answer. Absolutely. Okay. Question number two. Was there either a scary or impactful moment in some way during your career that or your life even before it that you believe really kind of learned something from that you take with you to this day?
Well, I think every time you step in an aircraft and come back for the debrief, you learn something. Some of those lessons are more powerful than others. What I think probably the most important thing that I've learned from flying, in addition to any particular technique or that sort of thing, is there is always learning to be done. And the best way to do that is just be honest about your performance. So when we go into a debrief, in a military flying debrief, we just talk honestly about, hey, what mistakes we made, what we did well, and just an objective look at what we can do better. And I've tried to take that not just from my flying career, but to my career as a commander and on the staff. And it's just to look at every problem objectively, be honest with what you did well, be honest with yourself, and be honest with others.
Excellent. Excellent answer. Okay. Question number three. If you had the opportunity to go back in time and just kind of re-experience a flight or some other moment during either your training, deployment, or current that was just so memorable that if you could go back and spend, say, 10, 15 minutes re-experiencing it again, where would you put yourself for that time?
Well, to go back to my previous answer, I don't think there's anything better than flying a low level in a fighter jet, especially if you're, you know, in between some mountain peaks and those sorts of things. So if you're just talking about kind of, pure aviation moments that I feel extremely privileged to participate in, I can go back into any low level I've done, and that's will always hold a nostalgic place in my heart. If there's something that's maybe a little bit more abstract, I think anybody who has flown an aircraft for a period of time will have those moments where, at least for a brief moment in time, you feel like you've really got it together, and time slows down, and you're thinking ahead of the aircraft. Those don't always happen, but it does make you feel that the blood, sweat, and tears of your training is worth it for those moments where you really feel you got to be a little careful not to get too cocky or confident. But those moments where you're like, okay, this is why I put in all those hours of training. It's allowed me to be in this circumstance and feel like I've got it together. Those are great moments when they happen.
That's wonderful. Okay, question number four. If you could go back in time and give some words of advice to your younger self in your teens or 20s, what would you tell yourself?
I think the advice I give myself might be different than others, because I'm probably more stubborn and less prone to listen than most people. Just in terms of aviation, there really is no substitute for just kind of hard work. It pays off at the end of the day. I was thinking the other day, I'll just tell one quick story about, I sat alert for many years in the District of Columbia Air National Guard at Andrews. And one of our jobs was to, potentially get airborne in a matter of minutes if there was a potential air threat. And several times I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and from dead sleep to airborne in a matter of minutes. And that's kind of both crazy, but it also made me realize that, hey, if you just, put in the work and you spend a lot of time on good habit patterns, and just some muscle memory and those sorts of things, it does pay off. So there are a lot of times where you may feel, hey, I'm not necessarily doing as well as I would like to, or I'm not getting the proficiency that I might want to. I just tell people, stick at it. The repetitions matter, the perseverance matters. Everybody's capable of doing that sort of thing. Just stick to it.
What great advice. I absolutely love that. All right, and the last question, and this is not limited to aviation in any way, shape, or form, but if you had the opportunity, if you could choose anyone alive or no longer with us throughout history or current, anybody at all, to spend an evening with, go get a drink or dinner, who would come to mind?
I don't know, probably either John Boyd or George Washington. How's that for two characters of history?
Excellent.
I think just picking their brains, and both big thinkers, but both folks that have had military experience, had unbelievable influence on our country and our military. I'd probably just ask them each a question and have them talk to each other. So
that's great. All right. Well, Major General Mark D. Piper, thank you so, so much for joining us here tonight on Social Flight Live. It's been absolutely fascinating. I am grateful for your service and for the service of everyone within NORAD, what they do to protect both of our countries, both the United States and Canada, and make this a safer world. And I really wish you the best during the holidays.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Jeff, and thanks for everybody's support. We couldn't do it without the support of the public. So thanks for all that you're doing, everyone on the call. We really appreciate what you do as well. Thank you.
Excellent. Have a wonderful evening.
Thanks.
Good night. And thank all of you for everything that you do to support General Aviation Beyond, and to support all the men and women that serve in our national defense, as tonight's show. And I wish you the best for wonderful holidays coming up. whatever you celebrate, and also upcoming a new year. We'll be off for both of those holidays, but we'll be back on January 7th with a very special show celebrating a look back on 2024 with aviation's year in review. And until then, again, thank you all so, so much. We appreciate it. Spread the word of the show. And I wish you all blue skies.